Welcome back to The Pleasure Project with Dr. Jen Kennedy. In this episode, I sit down with Annie Finch, who is a skillful therapist. She and I talk about betrayed partners and what that path looks like. Now, we talk a lot about sex addiction in our practice. That's something that we both have a lot of skill and training in. But the flip side of that is the partner. The partner often doesn't get enough attention, doesn't get seen or really supported properly. Annie runs a group specifically for betrayed partners, and it has been so powerful. I've watched it over the last year just really flourish. She has helped so many people. So in this episode, we sort of boil down like what happens, what is the arc of that situation, and what specifically works in the group setting to help really support these partners, both male and female, who are sitting in such a tough position after betrayal. So I hope you tune in and I welcome your feedback.
All right, so welcome back to The Pleasure Project. Today's guest is Annie Finch, and Annie is an associate marriage and family therapist. She started her counseling career as an addiction counselor for people with substance use disorder. She has her own experience with addiction, and that led her to want to help others to obtain sobriety and to help families heal from the devastation that addiction causes. Annie has worked as a lead treatment counselor and as a perinatal treatment program manager. Currently, Annie is in private practice at Riviera Therapy. So full disclosure, she is part of our team, where she sees couples and individuals. She specializes in the treatment of anxiety, trauma, couples work, sex addiction, and substance use addiction. Annie also specializes in group therapy and facilitates a betrayal trauma group, which is what we're talking about today. So her group members are partners affected by sex addiction. Annie has considerable experience working with couples and helping them strengthen their relationship and improve their communication skills. So welcome.
Thank you, Jen. I'm glad to be here.
Yeah. So Annie has been running this group for quite some time now, and it's doing so well. And I'm thrilled to have her here with us because she really, really understands this piece so well. So I'm hoping we can really kind of dive into betrayal trauma and understand sort of what it looks like from mostly the partner side. But let's start out by defining it. Like, what constitutes betrayal trauma?
So betrayal trauma is a trauma that happens when you've been betrayed by a significant other. We're talking about partner betrayal in this instance. Basically, it creates a lack of trust and safety in the relationship, and it is really an attachment wound. It's an emotional wound, and it's also a sexual wound for betrayed partners. It's a complex trauma. It's not a single episode trauma, and it is devastating for the partners who have experienced betrayal.
Yeah, and say more about what complex trauma is.
So complex trauma is something that is more complex than a single episode trauma. So often we think about complex trauma in relation to childhood or developmental trauma. It actually affects the way you develop as a human and as a person. It affects your relationships. It affects how you function in the world. It can affect how you feel about yourself and self-esteem. So betrayal trauma is complex because it's relational. So how you feel about yourself is often reflected in how your relationships are going. So if you're betrayed by a significant other, that feeling that maybe like, what did I do? Or if there's any like feeling, how you feel in the world and how you cope with emotions and how you cope with life is really, really affected.
So what are some common struggles that the partners are experiencing?
So common struggles for partners who experience betrayal trauma are often just coping with emotions. So they're really emotionally dysregulated. They have difficulty focusing and completing tasks. Often they have flashbacks to the actual discovery incident, or their mind is fantasizing about what might have happened in the betrayal. So if it's an affair, often they get really hyperfixated on the affair partner. They have trouble in other relationships. They have trouble trusting themselves. It really completely hijacks your life.
Mm-hmm. It's so disorienting. It's confusing. It's enraging. It's right. It's they're really going through the whole range of emotions.
Exactly. So like, there's trouble recognizing and expressing emotions and managing those emotions. Often it can lead to anxiety and depression. It can lead to substance use disorders. It can lead to blaming yourself for the actual betrayal. And then the thing that really is hard, I think, for betrayed partners is kind of the hypervigilance they feel over their entire life. So they're constantly tracking what's going on, just feeling like something bad could happen at any moment.
I mean, that hypervigilance reminds me too of like the PTSD that others experience, right? So veterans, we know that they have PTSD. Mm-hmm. I would say partners also experience that. And so with it comes this urge to be checking devices, checking phone logs, checking the car, you know, checking the location services, right? It's the hypervigilance of, am I safe?
Exactly. So that sort of checking behavior, kind of that controlling behavior, probably the partner who did the betrayal would think of it as controlling, is actually something that is trying to help them maintain, you know, some sort of safety in their life. But it can be very disruptive. They end up being sort of the gateway to the other person's recovery.
Right. And we'll say more about that. What do you mean the gateway? How so?
So if you're constantly checking somebody else's phone, or you're looking at their computer, you're, you know, checking websites and things like that. Often if the betrayer often feels like they're being micromanaged and they're being watched over, and that creates a problem not only with the person who's doing the checking, it keeps them in this position of kind of micromanaging the betrayer, which really takes the responsibility, as opposed to the betrayer taking responsibility for himself. And I wanted to say something about those two terms, betrayed partner and betrayer. So those are really sort of black and white statements right there, right? Betrayer and betrayed partner.
Yeah. Good point.
I want people to know that this is, the betrayers often come from a place of trauma as well. The reason that they, especially in terms of sex addiction, they have experienced their own traumas, often sexual abuse, relational traumas of their own, intimacy disorders, developmental problems. And that is one of the things that leads them to the acting out behaviors to provide them a sense of relief from just life in general. So there's a lot going on underneath sex addiction and affairs that I don't think the regular population would necessarily think of. We just kind of think of it's either good or bad. And then the betrayed partner is so much more as well. Like, they have jobs, they have kids, they have friendships, their daughters, mothers, sisters, friends, and also they're male, or, you know, gender unbiased. This is non-discriminatory. It affects all people from all walks of life and genders.
Yep. Yep. And so the idea that there's dimension to this, there's context, right? That always has to be considered. It's not like there's a cookie cutter, like, because some people will say, once a cheater, always a cheater. Like, that's it. And it's such a simplification of something that's actually quite complicated and nuanced, because partners have very different stories. And the same situation affects people differently.
Correct.
And so, you know, it really depends on your history. It depends on your own psychology. It depends on your relationship, how you respond to this betrayal.
Exactly.
Yeah. Do partners tend to blame themselves?
So, yes, this kind of goes back to what I was talking about before. There's this sense that if you take the responsibility, it gives you a sense of control, right? Mm-hmm. So if you say, if only I was prettier, and then you go do something to you think is going to make you prettier, or if I was just thinner, or if I made more money, or if I was funnier, or if I was more attentive, there's this idea, if I change those things, I am going to be able to control the behavior. The behavior and the responsibility are 100% owned by the betrayer, the person who did the betrayal. They have choices, and I have to kind of be careful about that because addiction is a loss of control. But the betrayed partner is not responsible for those behaviors. They didn't cause it. They can't cure it. Mm-hmm. There's nothing they can do to change the acting out behaviors. There's certainly things they can do for themselves to bring themselves into their own recovery. The blame on themselves is really kind of it can also be a form of denial where, you know, if I just don't see it, it really didn't happen. So I'm just going to blame myself instead of blaming my partner. And then that goes into a whole bunch of other stuff, like that sense of safety. If I can still trust my partner, I feel safe.
And I've seen people flip-flop too, where initially there's a lot of anger and dismay, and then they do shift into like a self-blame. Like, did I cause this somehow by not being available enough or attentive enough, or like you said, you know, attractive enough or enough, variations of enough. And that's just a rabbit hole that distracts from what's really going on for the betrayer is.
And it's interesting because I know the Pleasure Project is about sexuality and healthy sexuality, and it really affects the betrayed partner's sexuality. It definitely affects the, if it's a sex addict, their sexuality is highly affected, but it affects the betrayed partner's sexuality as well. Like sometimes when they've experienced betrayal, they will become hypersexual in the hopes of stopping any acting out behavior, or hypo sexual, where they just shut off completely and then have a really hard time getting back in touch with their own healthy sexuality.
That makes sense, right? There's this sometimes the hypersexuality to try to secure and to try to bring, you know, give them some sense of normalcy or, you know, connection, albeit, you know, kind of the wrong approach.
Right.
A shutdown and a sort of removal from the whole thing and disconnect and inability to feel a desire. All of that's super normal.
Yeah, it's called sexual anorexia, and it's really sort of this repulsion about sex, and it can be very complex and needs to be treated.
So are most betrayed partners surprised? If you can even like categorize most?
I think yes. However, there's this idea that something is going on underneath the surface of this relationship. So there's sort of this sense of knowing that something's wrong without being able to put a finger on it. Right. And sometimes there's actual relief when they find out about the betrayal because they're like, oh my God, I wasn't going crazy. And usually what happens is there's a finding out, there's a discovery, and then there's more sort of finding out. There's often the discovery can be sort of staggered by, in terms of like what behaviors happened when, and were there multiple affairs, or where, you know, is there porn addiction too, or is it just porn and not affairs? Is, you know, there's all sorts of layers to what was going on, and that can be staggered. So there can be the initial finding out, and then mm-hmm. it becomes staggered after that. And there's some treatment we can do around that as well, which helps everyone involved come to know exactly what was going on, so that the partner can feel like they have their eyes open and that they can make informed choices.
Right, because part of what's so difficult in this is not knowing, not having all the information to make good choices about staying in the relationship, or, you know, the partnership and what's happening between you, and just that kind of that frustration and upset.
Right.
So I know you've got all this training in sex addiction. And so not every betrayer is a sex addict, but there are some parallels in terms of the addiction model, because you've mm-hmm. also worked in substance addiction. So can you just speak to that a little bit?
Yeah, so I think the easiest way of understanding addiction is, I call them the three C's. So there's a loss of control. So loss of control over a behavior, or let's just say substance use. There's a loss over the use of alcohol or drugs. Then there's the compulsion or the craving, which is like, I have to have it. I like to say it's like literally having your skin peeled off if you don't get it. It's so uncomfortable that it precedes any rational thought, and you just need to have the acting out behavior to be able to feel the relief. And then there's the consequences associated with the acting out behavior. And often in the beginning, the acting out behavior is, or the substance use is, like filled with relief. It's all good. And then slowly but surely, those consequences start kicking in, and mm-hmm. things start to happen. It could be you're spending time focusing on your affair partner at work, or you're not coming home on time, or if it's substance use, you might be drinking and driving. And so those consequences start to build mm-hmm. up. And so we like to say in addiction, it used to be fun, and then it was fun with problems, and then it was just problems. Mm-hmm. So there's definitely a link also between substance use and sex addiction. And then there's, you know, affairs. There's somebody who mm-hmm. might have an affair who might not be a sex addict. They might not have a substance use disorder, but there's maybe an intimacy disorder where they decide to have an affair to feel better.
Right. An intimacy disorder being that they really don't have the skills or the comfort to like actually have sustained closeness, which is more of what a longer term partnership looks like versus the excitement of something new, like an affair would be. Yeah.
Right. And that tends to go to that, like people who are maybe anxious in relationships or avoidant of relationships. Mm-hmm. Often mm-hmm. what underlies that is just sort of this fear of being left or being abandoned.
Yeah. Okay. So in your experience with, I know you run the partners group, you've been running that for quite a while. Do the partnerships tend to stay together? Like, do people get through this? Does the relationship stay intact sometimes?
Absolutely. In fact, in my group, most of the partners are working on their relationships, and they're getting help. Their partners are getting help. Sometimes they have couples therapists, depending on where they are in the recovery process. I've seen all sorts of statistics that are all over the place, depending on who's giving you the statistic. But generally, what I feel is at least 50% or more try to repair the relationship. That doesn't necessarily mean that it's going to be repaired. It really depends on the work that they do.
Do you see consistent characteristics or dynamics that tend to lead toward, relational repair?
I think it's really important for the betrayer to take full responsibility, right? Yeah. And to get really honest, not just with their partner, but with themselves. And they have to do the work to find out why they acted out in the first place. Maybe they had an affair. Why did they have an affair? Without pointing the finger at their partner. They have to look internally.
Yeah.
Inside.
What were they seeking? Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. What were they seeking? What sort of relief were they looking for? And so that's essential. And then they need to, you know, possibly join a support group or definitely get some therapy around this, because it's a big topic and it needs to be explored, processed, talked about. And it's very helpful if people get support, especially betrayed partners. They often feel isolated, and that support is essential.
Yeah. And there's great 12-step meetings for sex addicts, if that's the population that, you know, the betrayer falls into. But the groups historically for partners are a little more sparse and less structured. So I really like having partners have an avenue to go in where they feel like this particular thing is being addressed and their situation is understood, you know, versus yeah. just like talking to friends. Cause a lot of times friends are just like, you gotta go, right? They can't sit through the complexity of like how, you know, this relationship means something and that repair might be on the table.
That's right. Betrayed partners often get told by friends and family, you know, you should just leave. And at that moment, their trauma is saying, wait a second, this person is the person I've felt safest with for however long they've been together. I can't leave. This is the person that I, even though they've hurt me, I feel safest with. So that's why it's so contradictory. And so for couples to stay together, the betrayed partner needs to get support from other people who have experienced the same thing. So they're getting more realistic feedback. I don't want to say anything bad about friends and family, because they are really trying to help their loved one, and they're seeing it definitely from that perspective of
they feel protective.
Yeah, they're protective. Yeah. My loved one's hurt. I want to protect them. But the betrayed partner might be seeing the person who actually betrayed them as the person who makes them feel most safe. And that's sort of goes to the phases of recovery. Initially, that sort of shock to the system of finding out about this betrayal, you know, there's this desire to like run away from it, but at the same time, that's the person who's made them feel safe, so they can feel really confused.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So let's talk about the group dynamic, because mm-hmm. I think walking into a group like this as a betrayed partner is probably pretty scary. And, you know, it's like, you don't want to air your dirty laundry, but you're walking in and you didn't even do the thing. You're just like, you're a victim of circumstance, and
right.
you also need support. So what does that look like when the group is happening? Like how is the partner, or how are the partners interacting, and how do they get benefit from one another?
Well, so they're all nervous when they first come in. They're meeting people they mm-hmm. haven't met before. They're talking about something that nobody wants to talk about. They've done an initial session with me to kind of make sure they fit for the group. And then really I invite the people who have been in the group the longest. So my group has been going consistently since June of 2023. And we're starting another month of the group. I go month to month and then everybody commits. So the people who have been in the group the longest share a little bit about their experience with betrayal. They share about their participation in the group and what they've gotten from the group. They really welcome the new betrayed partner into the group to help them feel safe and supported. So, and then as the groups move along, the new betrayed partner gets to share more They get to express their feelings. They get to share their story, which is so important.
Yeah.
You have to keep sharing your story. If you keep stuffing it down, you can't get it out. So processing their story, talking about their feelings, sharing experiences with each other. And so the dynamic of the group is really one of support and of understanding. It's so diverse. We have such a diverse group of people. It's a mixed gender group, and we welcome anyone, no matter what your gender is, or if you're binary, sexual orientation. So it's, I have men, I have women. So yeah, it's, I think people feel really supported in that group and feel welcome no matter who you are.
Yeah. So non-binary, if you're non-binary, right? If anything, anything goes, right? We welcome all genders.
Yeah.
How does that, because people assume, I think, that the betrayed is going to always be female, and oftentimes it's not. It could definitely, I've got several male clients that fit in that population. How does that dynamic change, or does it? Like, do you notice?
I found that, so there's a part of it that doesn't change at all. Everybody has experienced betrayal, and they are deeply wounded and hurt. They are trying to find firm ground to stand on. They have experienced, you know, this attachment wound where they don't feel attached to anything. And so they come in with this feeling of like, I just need support. And, so with, but the male clients that I've had join the group, they've shared their experience with the female clients, and there has been, an amazing sense of healing, I think, for the female clients, that they're not alone in this, that it really is non-discriminatory. I think they get to hear, the pain from a male perspective. Often this treatment can be defined by male, female. Males are the addicts or the betrayers, and females are the betrayed partners. But that is far from the truth. I have female sex and love addicts. I have male betrayed partners. You know, when they're in the group together, sharing their betrayal story, it doesn't really matter the gender at that point. But I do think that gender, especially having males and females talk about it together, is healing.
Do people, I'm just thinking, a lot of folks that are probably listening to this have never been in a 12-step meeting or in a group processing type situation. So they're like, how does this happen? Like, how do people talk? Do people tell war stories? Do they, you know, I don't know, like, what's the dynamic, I guess, if you could share.
Sure. So I kind of have the group structured a little bit, and, you know, people do share their stories, but they're not necessarily war stories. So in a 12-step program, you know, there's this rule, you don't share your war stories, right? Because it can be triggering for other people. Well, the same sort of situation can happen in a group dynamic as well. When somebody's sharing their story, it might trigger somebody else. So there's certain things that we kind of, you know, I think just out of respect for everyone, the group members share their story, but in a way that is mostly about their own experience and about their feelings and about how they're trying to move through it, as opposed to focusing directly on the, you know, the betrayed acting out or venting about their partner and how awful they are. They're really sharing from that sense of, like, this is what is going on for me. This is how I'm trying to get through this. This is where I'm struggling. Often I'll bring up in group, like, the sense of grief and loss that everyone is experiencing, right? The sort of the grief that this situation has happened, but also the loss of years of being together, and that sense of, like, knowing what your relationship is all about, and then maybe even a loss of what your future looks like.
Definitely, because invariably that is that course of action, like of travel has changed, right? By this betrayal has set you on a new course, and maybe you're still with that partner, but your future is going to look different. And so it's even just grieving that loss sometimes.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Grieving the loss, the way you thought the relationship was.
Now, do you bring in prompts, or like, do you have themes, or like how are the groups structured?
So the group is structured. We usually, I might share a little bit of a psychoeducational component, something that I've done some research on. I'm always reading. I'm also always listening to podcasts and things to expand my knowledge, and I'll bring those in. So there can be a little bit of a psychoeducational component. We always do a check-in, and we make space for someone who is going through something particularly challenging that week so that they can get support. Often when people are sharing, I'll hear a theme. Maybe it's grief and loss, or maybe it's a lack of self-care, or maybe it's struggling to find anything happy in life, or any gratitude for what's going on in their life. And so I might bring something up like, you know, so tell me how that particular situation is keeping you stuck. So I really want to know where the partner is feeling stuck. So often I'll say something like, well, how is that keeping you stuck in this feeling, or in this behavior, or in this sense of loss? Like, how can we move through that?
Right. So it feels like, yeah, you're processing. It's a process group, but also that, you know, you're helping them understand their own inner world a bit better. And I think groups are wonderful for that, in terms of sometimes you don't even know what you're feeling. So hearing someone else express that helps, you know, helps the first person like understand, because they're hearing it and they're like, oh yeah, that makes sense. And that's what I feel too. Oh, that's not how I feel. Right. So it helps by even just differentiation. But there's some of that normalizing and familiar, you know, hearing other people's experience.
Yeah, I love when I'll say something, or I'll make a comment, and somebody will say, no, that's not how I'm feeling. You know, the group is safe, and they can say exactly what they're feeling at the time, whether or not they agree. And they tend to go deeper when there's that sense of trust and safety in the group.
Yeah, that makes sense. So I guess lastly, like, when you think about the trajectory, the arc of recovery, and it doesn't obviously look the same for everybody, but kind of what are some signposts along the way that you see for these betrayed partners?
So there's kind of phases to recovery. So the first phase is when you find out, you're in a sense of shock, right? And really that's about becoming stabilized. You know, how can you be stable? What do you need to create some stability in your life? What does your partner need to do to help you find that stability? So in that point of time, it would be really important for the betrayer to establish their own recovery, maybe attend some SAA or SLAA groups, that's Sex Addicts Anonymous or Sex and Love Addicts Anonymous, find their own support group for, if they're a sex addict, a support group for sex addicts is really important. And most importantly, like, start to express that empathy and remorse that is so healing to the betrayed partner when they hear that person genuinely empathetic and remorseful for their behaviors. That can be very stabilizing. And then after that, it's really about being able to tell your story and to get support from other people who understand. So that's where they get that in my support group. So the first part really would be helpful if the betrayed partner got their own individual therapist. And if it's related to sex addiction, definitely a CSAT, that's a certified sex addiction therapist. We've been trained to understand the phases of recovery and how to help people move through. In that second phase, getting support, maybe even going to their own Sex Addicts Anonymous, the Al-Anon for Sex Addicts Anonymous groups, doing their own individual work. I think it's important for them to find out how they can take care of themselves.
I was going to say self-care is just huge. It's a support system is helpful, but it's also what's going on in your inner dialogue that's so critical to, regaining kind of stability and self-worth.
Exactly. So that self-care, what do you need to do? And addressing any physical things that are going on in your life. Often betrayal can lead to physical health issues. So people have digestive issues or they have chronic pain. We see that a lot in betrayed partners. So getting that looked at. Working on the couple's work, if both partners are really ready to work on what happened, you've got to address the trauma in the room first. And then once that's been stabilized, then you can start working on the relationship and communication and, how to create more intimacy. Of course, safety and trust come first.
And typically I know we're not doing couples out of the gates, because oftentimes the betrayer doesn't really have their head around what's even going on. And so they can't start really being different and making a true living amends. They can't express the empathy you mentioned because they're not there yet. So it's sort of a process to get them stable enough for them to be able to then return and do the heavy lifting of partners, of couples work.
Absolutely. They have to really understand what the problem is and how it's affecting them to be able to kind of move towards their partner and be able to express that genuine remorse and empathy. And so that takes their work. The other thing I wanted to say was there's something we haven't talked about, which is a disclosure process. Often there's a discovery, but the betrayed partner doesn't have all the information. That's held by the betrayer, right? And so there is a therapeutic disclosure that can happen where they both have their own therapist, and the addict or the betrayer shares with the betrayed partner all of the things the betrayed partner needs to know to feel safe. And that needs to be handled in a very therapeutic way with therapists who understand the nature of betrayal trauma.
Right. But that's usually a demarcation when that, after disclosure, then we start the couple's work.
Right. Yes.
Yeah. So typically kind of in that arc. So.
Yes.
Well, this has been so helpful. Thank you for your insights.
Welcome.
If you are interested in joining Annie's group, you can reach out to her. Her email is annie@rivieratherapy.com. And you can find out more about her, and her bio is there, and then also information about her group. So feel free to reach out to rivieratherapy.com. So thanks, Annie.
Thank you, Jen.